Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today because we get to talk about quite an interesting, thought-provoking book written by Dr. David Sutton, who is with us to tell us about it. The book is titled Bigger Fish to Fry, A Theory of Cooking as Risk with Greek Examples, which explores some really interesting questions that have sort of anthropological elements, political elements, philosophical elements, and also relate to the literal act of cooking, of preparing meals. So lots to think about here. David, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show, Miranda. I really look forward to talking to you.
Likewise. Could you perhaps give us a bit of a foundation to start with, introducing yourself and explain why you decided to write this book?
Sure. I'm a professor of anthropology at Southern Illinois University, where I've been teaching for the last 25 years. And I also am visiting professor at the University of Gastronomic Sciences in Palenzo, Italy, where I teach a yearly course on the anthropology of food. And in terms of writing the book, well, I have to give you a little bit of background. I've been doing research on this Greek island called Kalymnos in the Eastern Aegean. I've been researching there for over 30 years. I've actually been going to the island for over 40 years since I first went on a study abroad program on the island in 1980. And I didn't plan to study food or cooking. I was interested in how people in Kalymnos and in Greece more generally think about the past in their everyday lives. And it was really in kind of hearing people's stories about the past that I started to notice how prominent food was in their memories, even memories that were 40 or 50 years old. There were all these food details in these stories, even if the food wasn't really central to the story at all. And that got me curious. It got me thinking about what is this relationship of food and memory? And it was at a time that anthropology really hadn't tackled that question at all. There weren't, and more generally, there weren't all these kind of memory cookbooks and things out there. And so I really wanted to think about what could anthropology say about this connection of food and memory, a connection that I would say that was important to me personally, too, because I always remembered things in the past, people I had met based on the meals I had eaten with them. My parents always thought this was kind of strange, but it was nice to come to a place where people seemed to share this preoccupation, and people actually would say if I was leaving the island to go back to the States briefly or for a longer period, they would say, eat this so that you remember Kalymnos. And that really kind of got into my head. And so I spent some time researching this food memory connection, and this kind of led me to the topic of both sensory experience and how important the understanding the senses is for understanding food, but also the ways that memory itself could be thought of as a sensory experience. And this led me to cooking. I realized that cooking was another topic that, even though it's so central to our lives, it's something that some people do every day. Anthropology and other fields really hadn't said very much about it. And so I planned an ethnographic project. I filmed people doing their everyday cooking on Kalymnos, and I wrote a lot about that, about cooking and gender and embodiment and various other topics. But as I was thinking about that, there was something kind of itching at the back of my mind that that cooking had, I could see this relevance to some of the other theoretical topics that anthropology had been preoccupied by, particularly ideas about the relationship of the past and present, or history, continuity and change. So I really wanted to write a book that was not just for people who are particularly interested in food. I feel like sometimes we compartmentalize, and people think maybe a book on food, well, I'm not a food person, so I don't need to read that. People who would read a new book on anthropological theory of ritual or kinship or something else just kind of push that to the side. And I really wanted to show how cooking could contribute to anthropological theorizing more broadly, and help us to answer questions about tradition and change, or continuity and innovation, that have these broader implications for our understanding of the relationship of the past, present, and future. So that's kind of how I thought about writing this book.
No, thank you for that introduction. I think it raises so many things that show up in the book, and I think kind of definitely, hopefully, will show up in the rest of our conversation as well. So thank you for giving us that contextual understanding. Because I now want to ask you to get more into the idea of everyday risk. Can you tell us a bit more about kind of what you mean by this, and why we might want to think about this in the context of cooking?
Yeah, and this was, I think it's really a little bit risky of me to center this book on this term risk, because I feel like risk, both in kind of our everyday use and in scholarship, it tends to mean something particular, and it's not exactly what I'm trying to get at in this book. There's this tendency to use risk, I think, to mean bad risk, things that could happen that are bad. So risk is typically something to be managed or minimized, and I was kind of interested in thinking about risk more in terms of like possibility or contingency. So potentially negative, but potentially positive as well. And, you know, I think even when we think about positive risk, there's a tendency to think about extreme situations like bungee jumping could be a positive risk, or on Calymnos, I found that people celebrated Easter and other important events by throwing dynamite bombs, something I wrote about. Obviously, that also had some negative consequences, but was seen broadly as a kind of positive risk. I didn't want to kind of focus on these extreme examples of risk, but kind of the way that in our everyday lives we confront contingency, and that this makes life meaningful in a way. And finally, I didn't want to kind of suggest risk as a kind of in the kind of ways that capitalist entrepreneurs talk about, you know, risk and reward, in a very kind of individualistic way, because I found that these ideas that I was dealing with are really embedded in a community, in social situations, in this larger cultural context that makes them meaningful. So why use the term risk at all when it has all these other associations that I wanted to make clear that I wasn't meaning by the term? I think it's my gamble that risk could be a productive concept if carefully defined, because it allowed me to bring together the work of some previous authors who used the term and who I really wanted to engage with. Without kind of saying more about that at this point, that was the kind of reason I kind of tried to parse out this idea of everyday risk as something to be studied.
No, I think that sets us up well to go into more detail about some of those thinkers later on. But before we get to that, again, kind of on this idea of foundations, right? When we talk about everyday risk in the kitchen, what kinds of risks are we talking about?
Yeah, exactly. I think you'll have to forgive me because it brings me to this this Frank Zappa song that maybe some of the listeners will remember, "The Dangerous Kitchen," which I wanted to include in the book, but the publisher said that I couldn't because of copyright. And so I think I just included a line or two. But he imagines all of these kind of terrible things, mold growing on the bread or the milk that's spoiled, or all of the disgusting things in the sink, all kinds of things like that. I think there is this kind of sense of when we're confronting the kitchen is very different from other everyday household chores. It has this kind of dangerous negative side, but also all of these positive possibilities as well. So I think it's a risk that once again is double-edged. And I think in a way you could say that in my book I really focus on two key kinds of risk, not just negative and positive, but one that's cognitive and one that's more embodied. So on the one hand, the cognitive aspect is you want to make something when you go into the kitchen. You're taking a risk. Is it going to turn out the way that you imagined it? This second, this more embodied or material aspect is all the contingencies that we might face in the kitchen as we interact with familiar or unfamiliar tools, ingredients, which are pliant or recalcitrant. I mean, we've kind of standardized our ingredients a lot in the U.S. and maybe in the U.K. as well. But, you know, in Greece, you know, people were still, when they would get a bag of lentils from the store, the first thing they would have to do is make sure that they separated all the rocks out from the lentils. So ingredients are not passive. They can be recalcitrant. They can have different qualities. And then all the social situations that we're navigating in the course of our daily cooking, which I became very aware of on Calendar Notes, how much, people were cooking in relation to social needs and social demands. In some ways, I focused on this more embodied aspect more in my previous book when I was filming people and doing the ethnography. But in this book, I wanted to really see what's the relationship of this embodied risk that we find in practices that sometimes are literally risky. I can talk about some of those, such as when in Greece, in Kalymnos, people would cut a loaf of bread holding it against their chest and kind of slice toward their chest as they did this, which, you know, when you see it for the first time or even the 10th time, you're like, wow, be careful there. But people, to my knowledge, nobody's seriously injured themselves doing that, but it looks pretty risky. So things like that, with what I'm calling this cognitive risk of kind of setting out to make something and then seeing how it turned out.
Thank you for going into more detail about that. I'm glad you mentioned the knife example, even just the photos in the book of it. It was like, oh, yeah. Okay. that one photograph, I was like, all right, I see your point about risk in the kitchen. Yeah. Fair enough. So
that's right.
Now that listeners have a picture to imagine, right, and an idea of kind of where we're going with this, let's get into then those thinkers, the theory. What theory and thinkers do you think are particularly relevant to these conversations of cooking and everyday risk? Who have you brought in that you want to discuss?
Yeah, well, one of the key theories that I'm engaging with is that of Marshall Sahlins, who was, I think, one of the most well-known anthropologists of the 20th century, and he. Well, let me say, you know, we know that categories are central to our understanding of foodways, and this comes from the work of Mary Douglas and a lot of food scholars, and maybe others know her work on why the ancient Hebrews don't eat pork, and it's because of the kind of categories that are invoked in eating are challenged by pork, which doesn't seem to fit into the categories of proper food. And so we know that categories are central, but Sahlins really tried to develop a notion of categories that could account for change. That is, he saw history itself as what he called the risk of categories in practice. So he was really challenging the idea that culture is just a static set of categories that we use to divide up the world, to show that each time we label something, each time we categorize something, which we're constantly doing consciously or unconsciously, we're we're applying a cultural category to understand what that thing is. But because that thing, that empirical reality, doesn't always conform to our category, there's some risk involved. And sometimes that risk will lead to change. He used this theory most famously to understand the death of Captain Cook, famously and controversially, very developed and interesting way. But he didn't use it to understand a mundane practice like cooking. And I thought, you know, there was the kernel of an idea here that could be really applied to cooking just as well as to this kind of very big example. So let me just kind of give you an example of what I'm talking about. Like, if you imagine cooking moussakas, which is this classic Greek dish of eggplant and potato with bechamel sauce, there are all kinds of contingencies that might come into play in the making of a moussaka. It's not a dish that you would make kind of every day. It would be kind of like a Sunday dish for a special meal. And lots of things could make it taste a little bit different, both things that you kind of thought about and planned, like, oh, I'm going to use pork instead of beef in the sauce, which some people do, or even lamb. Some people use that. Other people would think that that's kind of strange. But it still might be eaten under the label moussakas. But this is what Salins refers to as the great gamble with empirical realities. The label, the category, insists on continuity. This is again, moussakas. I've had this before, and I'm having it again. While the practice is always going to have some change in it. Sometimes you might notice the change. Sometimes you might not notice the change. Sometimes the change might be laughed off or would be seen as disgusting. I did something and it became disgusting or inedible, so that change gets pushed aside. But sometimes that change might kind of expand the category itself. So a little change in practice might lead to a different understanding of what's included in the category moussakas. And I give an example of this in the book, where a woman was pouring the bechamel sauce on top of her moussakas, and she saw that she had made a little bit too much, so she just grabbed something nearby and started stirring it a little so that the bechamel sauce kind of sunk down a little bit into the other layers of the dish. And she thought it turned out great. She thought instead of this kind of just this layer of bechamel sauce on the top, there was the taste of the bechamel kind of running much more through the whole dish. And so this kind of gave her a new understanding of moussakas. Whether that little change, she told friends about it, whether other people would adapt it, whether it would be kept or discarded over time. These are the kind of questions about how does change happen? We know change happens, but I was suggesting that this might be one way to understand how the change in a dish actually occurs through people's everyday practice.
Thank you for taking us through that. I think it's a really interesting way of reframing something probably a lot of us have analogous experiences of, but don't think about in that sort of way. And I'd love to stay on this idea of kind of categories and what counts as being part of something, because you talk about in the book the idea of craft practice, you know, what counts as a craft. Why do you think we might want to think about cooking as a craft? How does this help us in this question of cooking as everyday risk?
Right. Well, this is where I kind of was trying to bring together this kind of cognitive approach represented by Salins. He was talking about kind of categories that are in our head, let's say. I was trying to bring that together with this more embodied approach to cooking that that was drawing on other anthropologists, people like Tim Ingold, but especially I found this craft theorist named David Pye had, you know, over 50 or 60 years ago, had developed this concept, what he called the workmanship of risk. And this was really his definition of what is craft, because I think people are trying to move away from the kind of idea of craft as a noun, like craft as something you could recognize by looking at an object, to craft as a process. So what makes something a craft is how we approach it and how we engage with the material. With the materials, whatever they happen to be, whether it's food or whether it's, you know, whatever other kind of material. And so this David Pye, so, you know, Salins has this phrase, the risk of categories and practice. David Pye had this phrase, the workmanship of risk, where he said the quality of the result is not predetermined, but depends on the judgment, care, and dexterity which the maker exercises as he works. As they work. I think that he was really developing a notion of craft as opposed to what he saw as the tendency in modern societies and capitalist societies to build on standardization. He called standardization the workmanship of certainty as opposed to the workmanship of risk. So we're talking about the difference between, let's say, a home-cooked hamburger with spices added that come to hand, maybe. You have the decision to use a frying pan or an indoor grill or an outdoor grill. It's made based on your taste preferences, the convenience, other contingencies of the particular situation versus, let's say, a McDonald's Big Mac, which has been designed to have no variability wherever and whenever and by whomever it is made, since workers themselves are meant to be replaceable in the workmanship of certainty. It's really the ultimate fantasy of American industrial food. And so I was using this concept of the workmanship of risk to really focus on what it means to engage with everyday contingencies and to accept that would be a better way in many cases. Of course, maybe sometimes you do want certainty in certain situations, but, you know, for a food system in general, I would argue that you don't want certainty. You want that kind of risk in a good sense of that when you make something, it's responsive to the particular context and situation, the material factors, the social factors, the sensory factors, all the things that you know. Well, so-and-so doesn't like onions, or so-and-so likes things blander or less bland, or all the things that, that go into our confrontation with the material of cooking. And more broadly, coming back to the cutting example, the cutting the bread. I mean, that was something that I was very interested in, that in Greece, people don't typically cut things, putting them down on a cutting board. They hold them in their hand, whether we're talking about an onion or a zucchini or an eggplant. Anything that you can hold in your hand can be cut in your hand. And it means that you're not relying on the cutting board to kind of provide stability. You're actually relying on the responsiveness of your touch. You actually can feel what you're doing in a different way. So I have a whole kind of argument about why cutting in the hand is much more efficient in some ways than one might think if one is trained as a professional chef to kind of do things in the most standard efficient way. But nothing about cutting is a foregone conclusion. There's an ever-present danger that it might go in a different direction. And that's what I wanted to capture in the idea of craft as risk, that that it's unpredictable, but that can be a good thing.
That's a good point to make. So thank you for taking us through that. Can I ask about another aspect of the book, in kind of along the same vein as thinking about it in terms of craft, but is there a politics to thinking about cooking as everyday risk?
Yeah, I think there's potentially multiple politics in this approach. I think, as I've kind of suggested, there's a little bit of a critique of capitalism in my last response, and I think that there's always been in capitalism this desire to replace individual skill and experience and even knowledge in decision making with procedures that are seen as impersonal and objective. At universities, we hear the term best practices a lot, and I think that this is it's a term that actually makes me cringe, because it just suggests that there's one way of doing things outside of context. And so I think that thinking about craft is really thinking about challenging that standardization. And we see this in kind of artisanal foods, artisanal cheeses, which have become so popular recently, for example, or breads. All of those things that you like, that because of their very nature, they can't be perfectly standardized so that every one that you get is the same as every other one, or as similar as possible. More than that, I think that there's this idea in popular culture of the perfect recipe. The perfect recipe the best way, once again, the best way to do something, the best way to cut an onion. I actually saw an article on, I think it was on this Slate, or one of these popular kind of cultural sites, about the best way to cut an onion. And once again, it was nothing like the way that people in Kalymnos cut onions. But this kind of labeling things as perfect or best is really, I feel like it's about removing the human element. It's a fetishization of technology. I think it's related to some of our ideas about neoliberalism more broadly. In Kalymnos and in Greece, I found that people were much more open to kind of ways to personal ways to do things, not standardizing, not even measuring things. I think that's one of the things that's very clear in Greek cooking and in other, not just Greece, but in other places too. There's this distrust of exact measurement. It's seen as in some ways dehumanizing. It's kind of like in Greece, when you buy things, people don't worry about exact change. That is also seen as dehumanizing. People use their bodies as measures, with the recognition that it's not going to be exactly the same every time. That if it were exactly the same, something essentially human would be lost, or maybe even essentially Greek would be lost. I think about, you know, all of our technological, I mentioned technological fetishism. I think about things like cooking robots. There have been like attempts for the last 15 or so years to design robots that can cook meals. And I think there was one developed in Japan called the MomBot, it was making omelets and maybe miso soup. And I remember I showed this a video of this robot to my friend on Kalymnos, Dimitris Roditis. I was interested in his reaction, because he was a computer programmer, and he's a technophile. He's basically single-handedly introduced most of the computers to Kalymnos, or understanding computers to Kalymnos, in the last 25 years. But despite his, let's say, modernizing tendencies, when I showed him this video, Dimitris was horrified by the prospect of eating the product of a cooking robot. He told me he found the idea of robot cooks deeply disturbing, since a dish is just not supposed to be the same every time. That's part of what makes cooking, is that it doesn't come out the same every time. Or as one of my colleagues, Leonidas Fornelis, put it, if you reproduce a dish that is the same as the recipe you used, what have I learned about you? Nothing. So this, I think, you know, these are different ways of getting at some of the politics of this risk that I'm talking about. I think it really does have some of these broader implications. Oh, and if I could just mention one other example. This is a kind of coming back to the categories notion of risk. I saw At some point when I was writing this, there was a New York Times, the New York Times published a recipe for a smoky tomato carbonara. And this recipe provoked this huge kind of outrage on social media as Italian chefs and other guardians of culture kind of expressed their dismay that a carbonara recipe could include tomatoes. It was seen as an attack on culture. One chef said it would be like putting salami in a cappuccino or mortadella in sushi. Okay, fine, but let's not call it sushi. So there's this idea that that there are boundaries to the categories and that we have to patrol and police them. And not saying whether I agree with that or not, I think that that also points to how these categories, the being put at risk, can have very much political implications, because it really is about how we define our culture and what is acceptable and what is not acceptable.
Thank you for taking us through the politics of this. I think it is really interesting to think about how it relates to these bigger questions about kind of what the culture is and what things mean. And in fact, I'd like to kind of even go further on that, because you talk about in the book, you raise questions of sort of existentialism. So can you explain to us why risk-taking has some existential quality in the context of Greek kitchens?
Yeah, and thanks for that question. I think it is really it goes back to what I said at the beginning about how important food was on Kalymnos, and the knowledge of food has a value in Greece that maybe it does in other places, maybe it doesn't. I think this is something that's culturally variable, kind of the extent to which taste matters to people. So I think the existential aspect comes both in the sense that that food is seen as central to a good life. And also that, let me just give an example of what I'm talking about there, because obviously listeners might say, well, of course food is important, but I do feel like there was something different in the sense that even though women do the majority of cooking on Kalymnos, though there are exceptions, the significance of knowing about cooking and knowing about how to produce taste, I found that across the board, women, men, young, old, everybody cared about that. Well, not literally everybody. I did find one or two people who said that they didn't care about the taste of their food, but really they were aware that they were unusual in this cultural context. And I remember just to give one example, this older man was telling me, I was talking to him and we got on the subject of octopus, and he said, you know, if you're going to cook an octopus, you really have to think about, are you going to first soak the octopus in water so that you draw out the salt water and then add salt back later? Or are you using the salt water that the octopus still has in it as part of your cooking? And he goes on and tells me all these things about the ins and outs of octopus. And I said, well, when was the last time you cooked an octopus? And he said, oh, I never cook octopus. It wasn't something that he did, but it was something that he felt was important to know and to talk about, to share with others. And so this is one half of the existential, this is the existential quality of food, but in terms of the existential quality of risk taking, this is where I really felt that it became clear to me that risk was seen as something not to be erased, but to be embraced as part of what gives life meaning in Greece on Kalymnos. There's a phrase in Greek, "Izoi neagonas," life is a struggle, and that's a very common phrase, but it takes its meaning through this shared culture that constantly affirms this idea that risk is not individual, it's the risk of those whose identity is really embedded in a family or a community. I mean, they have their own particularities, of course, but is seen as something, once again, that you need to engage with in order to create meaning. Other anthropologists of Greece have talked about this, once again, in other contexts, in more male contexts, and I felt that this really applied to cooking as well. Once again, that contingency wasn't something to be mitigated by improved tools or techniques, but potentially added to the joy of creating a good dish or a good meal.
Thank you for adding that aspect in. I wonder if we can kind of take all the things we've been discussing and apply them, I suppose, more directly to you, go from the existential big picture to the more personal. How have your own attitudes towards cooking and recipes been informed by all of this?
I have learned a lot from my Kalymnian friends about through thinking about this, about kind of acknowledging that we don't know and can't know what will happen next, but this creates possibilities. It affords possibilities. We're always, I've become more and more struck in my own cooking that, I think if people like to use recipes, I understand that. But I feel like so much of good cooking just comes from following your senses. And I think that there's just an improvisational aspect of it that I'll start with one idea, and just in the midst of making it, it'll go in a different direction. I really feel like, some people think that, there are a lot of rules that you have to learn to be a good cook. But I really feel like I respect the cookbook writers who kind of dispense with the notion of rules. I think Melissa Clark is one of them, who says that, the only rule is, don't burn down the house and don't cut off your finger. But everything else is kind of up for grabs if you trust your senses. This is something that I learned I learned as a child from my father, who would tell me things like this, but I didn't really understand the implications of it until much later. So I think that these are some of the things that I've taken. And once again, I think in the U.S., we're so preoccupied with standardization, ratings and rankings and the best this, and there's something it doesn't allow us to enjoy the productivity of trusting one's everyday senses. And you know, I don't want to say that, you know, in Calamnos people didn't judge cooking to be good or bad. They did, but it once again, it was in this social context where cooking was seen as collectively meaningful to families and communities, and so it was not part of creating some abstract notion of ideal or perfection, but of, once again, being able to accept what life throws at you. And so I've tried to take that into the kitchen with me. And I think that it's actually led to some of my more interesting dishes, more creative dishes that, you know, didn't start out. And I reflect on this in the book a little, some of my particular, I do a little bit of autoethnography of some of the dishes that I've made many times. And just, I think it's interesting to follow how they change over time. Even a dish that you've made literally 100 or 200 times, it's very much not the same dish at the end of that process than it is at the beginning.
I think that's definitely true. I only just have, I guess, a final question that nicely builds off of that. Obviously, it sounds like you're going to continue cooking and continue evolving your cooking practice. Is there anything else you might be currently working on or looking to work on that you'd like to preview or share with the audience?
I think that one of the things that really surprised me actually when I was doing this work, and that's kind of led to a new project that I'm hoping to work on in the future, is that when you see kind of tourist photos of Greece, a lot of the beautiful blue and white landscapes and people's houses. And there's often like a pot of basil in the picture. And this is because it's literally true that almost every home in Greece tries to have a pot of basil on their doorstep and maybe more basil plants in their garden. What's kind of strange about this perhaps is that people don't usually eat the basil. They love the basil, but they don't like it in food. And so when I started to recognize that, I was wondering why people don't eat basil. And I found that this is kind of anthropology 101, that all our tastes, you know, have a context. And so for people in Greece, basil is not that nobody eats basil. You can eat basil, but it's not seen as part of Greek cooking. And when I ask people about this, they say it's because basil is too meaningful to be eaten. It has all of these associations and meanings. It has these deep religious associations. It's used in funerals. It's used all the time by the priests to spread holy water. I found there's like literally dozens of songs in Greece about love and basil. That basil is seen as kind of the representation of love, men singing about basil, women singing about basil. It's really striking, and people get very emotional in talking about basil. And so so I think this is one thing that I'd like to pursue in the future is kind of why basil is too important to be used in cooking on a daily basis.
Goodness, well, that's fascinating.
Yeah. And the only other thing I'd say is I'm trying to do more foraging. I think that my cooking needs to incorporate foraging. I just feel like this is really important. I've been trying to learn about, there's just so many things out there that are just growing that we can be eating. I start with dandelion greens. Everybody hates dandelions, and yet they're delicious. So I've been collecting dandelion greens all over my little town. I think people probably see me and think, why is that professor picking dandelions? But I think that that foraging needs to be make a comeback.
Mm. Well, thank you for highlighting both of those to us. They sound very interesting. So best of luck with the foraging and the basil research. And of course, listeners intrigued can read the book we've been discussing, titled Bigger Fish to Fry, A Theory of Cooking as Risk with Greek Examples. David, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you, Miranda. It was a real pleasure to talk to you.